too many times during my career, you know, I was told I was ambitious and it wasn't meant as a compliment. But here's the thing, Archie, think about it. I mean, you would never like raise your children and tell them to work hard, get good grades, get involved in sports and extracurriculars and take on extra work and show leadership and volunteer to all these things and then say, oh, but do not be ambitious.
Right. Know this, wherever you are on your personal and professional leadership journey, you can take your game to the next level. Welcome to Training Camp for Leaders with Archie L. Jones, Jr., the podcast that will help you dream bigger and pursue your goals more confidently. How's it going, leaders? Our guest today is a real force of nature. She's smart, driven, and unapologetically ambitious, which is what this episode is all about. I'm talking about Shelly Archambault. She is one of Silicon Valley's first Black female CEOs, who was at the helm of MetricStream, and now serves on several high-profile boards. Shelly is exactly the kind of guest this show was made for, because she gives it all. Personal stories, practical advice, and endless inspiration. Above all, Shelly is proof that you should never compromise on your dreams and always reach for greater heights. I'm sure you'll enjoy our conversation as much as I did, and I'll do my best to sum it all up in my key takeaways afterwards. Let's go. You know, I counsel my leaders and students on, tell me the big, hairy, audacious goal before we get to the next chess move or the next step that you want to make. You had the vision of, you knew you wanted to be a CEO. What created that as the vision or that as the big, hairy, audacious goal, if you will?
I was tired of being cold. So my father didn't have a college degree. We moved around. I lived in 7 states before high school because every time there was an opportunity to improve his lot, we took it. You know, he had 4 kids in 5 years and he was like, okay, I got to support family, got to grow the whole bit. And in my family, you know, I remember my junior year in high school, you know, you have that obligatory conversation with the guidance counselor, which is, are you going to go to college? And the answer was yes. In my family, the key was you get good grades so you can go to a good college, so you can get a job. Right. And then you're set. I mean, that was it. That was the whole goal. Okay. So she said, do you want to go to college? Yes. What do you want to do when you get out of college? And I said, I don't know. All I know is I want to make enough money so I can keep my thermostat at 72 degrees. I want to be able to eat out at restaurants and I want to be able to travel because those were all things that I couldn't do. Right. Oh. And literally she laughed. Then she looked at me and realized I was actually dead serious. And she said, well, oh, what do you like to do? And I said, oh, that's easy. Clubs. I'm like in everything. American Field Service, French Club, National Honor Society. I'm like, I'm even a Girl Scout, but like, don't tell anybody. You know, I was in everything. And I liked leading them, right? I was president of the French Club. I was vice president of American Field Service. Then I was president. Then I did this. I mean, and so she said, well, you know, clubs are like business. You get people together and you get things done. And I said, sold. And I like to run these clubs, so I'll go run a business. And when I looked up, the people that were in businesses were called CEOs. So I said, I'm going to go be a CEO. Came home and told my parents, I'm going to be a CEO.
Fantastic.
Now, Archie, I had no idea what that actually meant.
I understand.
I mean, I was like, okay, that's what I'm going to do. Because I've always been goal-oriented. You know, I learned very early in life that the odds were not in my favor. And so the way I've always improved my odds is I just set a goal. And then I figured out how to improve my odds to make the goal happen. So once I decided I was going to be CEO, I was like, that's the goal. And so everything I did was, how do I improve the odds to make that happen?
Why do you say the odds weren't in your favor?
Oh, gosh. Remember I mentioned moving around so much? All right. So I was in elementary school in the 60s, right? Early 70s, that period of time. And the U.S. was a tough place for little Black girls who were moved into very white neighborhoods. And many times I was not only the only girl, Black girl in my class, but in my grade. And once I was the only Black girl in like the school, because I was in first grade and my siblings, I'm the eldest, weren't in school yet. So I was it. And I got bullied. I got beat up. It was just really clear to me, all my experiences kind of coming up in that kind of environment, that the odds aren't in my favor. And if I just did what everybody else did, I wasn't going to get anything. So I had to figure out how to be more intentional, because my parents, to their credit, you know, their message to me, when you come home and your knees are scraped up because you got pushed down on the playground, and no, mom, it's not fair. It's not fair. And she'd look at me and she'd say, Shelley, life's not fair. And she's like, what? I mean, like, you're a kid. Life's supposed to be fair. You get a lollipop, I get a lollipop. You get a turn, I get a turn. And she was like, no, it's not. Life isn't fair. So what are you going to do about it?
What do you know? Turns out young Shelley was right. As you hear, being intentional eventually got her that dream CEO job and much more. I want to start off with MetricStream and how you turned around that struggling startup to a successful company.
In 2 minutes or less?
Yeah, exactly. How'd that opportunity cross your desk? How'd that come to you?
Yeah, so here's what happened. I decided very early in my life, Archie, that I wanted to run a company one day. And I spent my entire career working to make that happen. So when I was finally chief marketing officer, VP of sales at a company called LoudCloud, I felt I was ready. LoudCloud was getting ready to go through a major change. They were going to change their company from an infrastructure company to a software company, and in the process, downsize it from like 350 people to about less than 100. And so to me, it was the perfect time now to go after my CEO job. Unfortunately, the market was terrible. This was 2002,
yeah,
right? And you're old enough to know.
I am.
In 2001?
Oh, yeah.
The market, the Silicon Valley, right? All startup world crashed, right? Dot-com bubble crashed. So when that happened, I mean, in 2002, Silicon Valley was littered with CEOs from companies that had gone out of business looking for jobs. I mean, I'm like, all right, I talked to people. And I'm like, do I have the skills? Do I have the capability? The answer is yes, yes. But the timing's terrible, Shelley. You know, go back to a big company and wait it out. And I'm like, nope. I've been working my whole career for a CEO job. If I've got the skills and I'm ready, then I'm going to go find one. But I knew that I wasn't going to get an A play, right? I wasn't going to get a company that everybody thought was going to be successful.
Yeah.
Because those were going to go to people in the network. At the time, I wasn't even living in Silicon Valley. I was commuting. And so I'm a foreign entity. Plus, I didn't happen to look like any of the tech bros that were going after CEO jobs in 2002.
Sure.
So I said, you know what? Let me go find a fixer-upper. Let me go find a problem child that I believe has the opportunity to turn around, because I've been fixing problems my whole career. So that's what I did. And I literally just went out and told everybody I could find, all right, here's what I'm looking for. Here's who I am. Network, talk to people, do the whole thing. I interviewed for several jobs, but the one that looked the most interesting to me and I thought had the potential to truly turn around was this very broken company called, at the time, Zaplet. Zaplet. And I figured, okay, I had a friend do the due diligence on the technology because I'm not a tech person. And told me that, okay, the technology is sound. I said, fine, technology is sound. Then all I have to do is to figure out a problem that this technology can solve that companies have. And so I took the job and it was worse than advertised.
Wow.
Oh my goodness. Just the rent alone was going to put the company out of business. I mean, it was just horrible. They were burning money, hadn't sold anything new in like a year to anybody. So it was a major turnaround. And how did we do it? We did it by literally starting with the basics, which is, all right, the technology capabilities, what are they? Once I understood the capabilities, then it was literally, I spent my time talking to the smartest people I could find about what problems do businesses have right now that they don't know how to solve. And in doing that, I found the area of compliance. You know, what I heard was, you know, this whole area of compliance, this is, you know, think of it. This was after Sarbanes-Oxley, right? Enron, this is all this stuff, all these rules and regulations and fines are being put in place. And companies were facing big issues if they couldn't comply or at least prove that they had complied with all these rules and regulations. So we took the software and we optimized for what I was calling comprehensive compliance and risk management. All right. It was a brand new space. There wasn't anything doing this. So we were evangelizing. for years. Turned the name into MetricStream because we merged with another company that was doing quality software, which is pretty close to what we were doing. So it gave us some heft. And the good news is, in about 2008, Gartner announced there's a new market out there called governance, risk, and compliance. And MetricStream is a leader.
Wow.
So after all that evangelizing, finally, it's like, yay, right? We're going to hit the map for the first time. Our phones are ringing. It's like, oh, this is great. This was in like January, February of 2008. And so we are like super. The board's excited. We double down. We hire salespeople, implementation people. We are like ready to go after all of this time of fighting and scraping and evangelizing. And then, you know what happened at the end of 2008. And it's like, really? Are you kidding me? Oh, so everything came to a halt, right? We had to lay off people. It was awful. And here we are. We were a startup. We'd spent our money to get ready for this growth. We limped into 2009 with barely enough money to cover quarters with payroll.
Wow.
All right. And I'm like, oh, so it's sitting down with the team and saying, all right, we have a choice. We can either fight or we can fold. What are we going to do? And we were like, you know, we worked so hard. We built this market. So we decided to fight. And that meant people took pay cuts. I came home and told my husband, what would you think if I like didn't pay myself for like a year?
I'm sure he was thrilled about that.
Oh yeah, especially since I was the sole breadwinner. He was a stay-at-home dad.
Oh boy.
So this was like a major. He was like, can we afford it? And I'm like, well, good news is we've always lived below our means. So, you know, he said, well, I've been poor before, I could be poor again. And so we did. And the good news is we not only survived, but ultimately thrived. And MetricStream still around today, still solving customer problems. They have customers and offices all over the world. So it's pretty exciting.
When did you first get interested in board service, public board service?
Need help, be candid, Archie. I didn't even really understand boards. I mean, I knew there was a board, but it really wasn't until I was probably in my early 30s that I finally learned that, wait a minute, the board of directors hires and fires the CEO. I'm like, I want that job too.
What is your superpower and how does that show up in the boardroom?
My superpower in the boardroom is courage.
Mm.
Because, you know, in a collegial business setting, right, people want to be supportive. They want to be helpful. And sometimes topics or issues or questions are hard to bring up or to raise. And I help. I call it getting elephants on the table. You know, that was when I was leading a company. That was my big thing. I actually had a stuffed animal in my office that sat in the chair. And that was always meant to say, listen, problems, issues, all these things that are kind of under the surface, let's put them right on top so we can deal with them. If they're underneath, I can't deal with it. I can't fix it. So I feel the same way in the boardroom. And so therefore, just being able to do that and to help us make the tough decisions and the hard calls and have the tough conversations.
We spend a lot of time talking about confidence. How do you connect confidence and courage? Are those the same things, different, working together? How do you think about those?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I don't think they're the same. I do think they work together. So, for instance, you know, I wasn't born with courage.
Mm.
Nobody's born with courage, Archie, right? We are flight animals, right? Mother Nature, we are born and we cannot protect ourselves. So therefore, we are flight animals. So anyone that you see who demonstrates courage actually built that muscle. And I do believe it's a muscle. So building courage was about taking risks and realizing that you could survive them. So I made it a point to take risks, to do things that I was afraid of. And if you do it enough, right, you build enough courage to realize, oh my God, I did it and I didn't die, right?
Yeah.
So that's the courage muscle. Confidence is a little different. You know, confidence is getting to the point where you believe in yourself that you can, and then it's fill in the blank, do something, achieve something, create something, build something, right? It's more of the action towards something else. So that's how I see confidence. Now, can they go hand in hand? The answer is absolutely. I think if you're courageous, you'll take more risks. And if taking more risks, you'll see more opportunity. That will help build some confidence. So they're definitely related.
Listeners, I hope you're taking notes because Shelly is dropping a ton of wisdom right now. In fact, she has so many lessons to teach, she wrote a book a few years ago called Unapologetically Ambitious. I love that title, so I asked her how she came up with it and what it means.
Well, the reason I named it what I did was too many times during my career, you know, I was told I was ambitious and it wasn't meant as a compliment. But here's the thing, Archie, think about it. I mean, you would never like raise your children and tell them to work hard, get good grades, get involved in sports and extracurriculars and take on extra work and show leadership and volunteer to all these things and then say, oh, but do not be ambitious.
Right?
Would you ever say that?
No, I would not.
No, right? And people like to tie ambition with something that it's not, right? I mean, ambition is not stepping on people and taking no prisoners and being, that's just being rude, okay? Ambition just means that there is something in the future that you want to build, create, impact, or experience, just something that you're working toward. Well, what is life if you're not working towards something? Everybody deserves to be ambitious. So Unapologetically Ambitious was titled that because everyone deserves to be ambitious and no one should have to apologize for it.
Is that what drove you to write the book?
Actually, what drove me to write the book was as I was coming up in my career, you know, I was a Black woman in tech in the 80s. So there weren't a lot of people doing what I was doing. And when people would reach out to pick my brain, hear my story, buy me coffee, right, et cetera, I tried to do it. But then as I took on more and more responsibility, I didn't have time to physically meet with all these people, right? I still responded. Matter of fact, I still do. If you send me a genuine LinkedIn article, request or a Instagram message or whatever, I try really hard to respond. And I do that because I want people to see that I'm a real person. You can touch me. So if you can touch me, you can be me. And I said, you know what? It was breaking my heart that I couldn't meet with all these people. So I said, when I get to phase two, when I pass my CEO baton, I'm going to write it down. I'm going to write down kind of what made Shelly Shelly, right? I'm going to write down all the things that people don't tell you. Like number one, life is hard. Life is hard. People don't actually tell you that life is hard, Archie. And so what happens is when it becomes hard, we think, oh my God, I'm not cut out for this, right? Oh, it's not for me or I'm not ready. That's baloney. When it gets hard, it just means you need to go get more help. And I talk in the book about how to get help. I talk about tactics and techniques to overcome hurdles and all those things, because frankly, it just irritates the heck out of me that so many people, but especially women and people of color, don't get the opportunity to contribute to their full capability. Heck, a lot of times, not even to 60, 70% of their capability.
Right.
And it's not because they're not willing to work hard, and it's not because they're not smart, right? And it's not because they don't know what they want. A lot of times it's because they hit a hurdle, they hit a roadblock, and they don't know how to get over it. So Unapologetically Ambitious is really about trying to give people, frankly, a toolkit on how to go after your ambitions and get what you want out of life.
I love that. And if it's not hard, it's probably not worth chasing in most cases, right?
There you go.
If it doesn't have some difficulty to it. We've had a lot of guests talk about imposter syndrome. As an unapologetically ambitious person, do you ever suffer from it or have to deal with it?
I talk about it all through my book. Absolutely. Absolutely. Just define to make sure we're talking about the same thing. What I'm talking about is that little voice, that little voice that creeps into your head when you're facing something new. You have a new opportunity or a new situation, right? Or a new job or going to speak in front of a group, something new. And that little voice creeps up and says, wait till they figure out you don't know what you're talking about, right? Wait till people understand that you're not as smart as they think you are, right? Wait till it's this voice is sitting there telling you, right? What do you think you're doing here, right? You're not smart enough. You're not brave enough. You're not capable enough. It's that voice. Well, studies show, Archie, that most people hear that voice at some point or another. Most people hear it. And so what that tells me is, you know what? It's not you. It's not me. It's like in the air, right? It's like the airwaves. Everybody hears it. And so what I tell people is, listen, yes, you hear it, but realize that it's like not real. It's not inside you. It's kind of in that air. So it's kind of like TV, right? I mean, you have TV, it comes across the airwaves. What happens when you watch something that's scary or icky or whatever you don't want to see? You turn the thing off, right? That voice, you turn that thing off. You tell yourself, listen, everybody hears this. This is not me. And if that doesn't work, then remember, you only feel it when you're facing something new. Well, you wouldn't have been given the new opportunity if the person or people who offered it to you didn't believe in you. So if you don't believe in yourself, believe them when they show confidence in you, right? And if that doesn't work, then fake it. Fake the confidence, not the knowledge. Fake the confidence. Because if you think about it, Archie, if you really think about it, eventually you figure it out.
You do.
And if none of those things work and you still can't, like, oh, I still can't take the job, that's when you call your cheerleaders. You call the people in your life that believe in you. You call them to remind you how good you are, how strong you are, what knowledge you have, so that you get that courage to move forward.
Tell me about mentorship then, and mentors and how you've used them.
Mentors are there to really help you develop, which means they're not always going to tell you you're doing great. They're not always going to tell you you got this, right? They're going to actually be direct and candid when it needs to happen. So it's different. Cheerleader, rah-rah all the time. Mentor is somebody who's trying to look at you holistically and is someone that you can go to for advice, counsel, and frankly, to tell you the truth and be candid. So mentors have played a huge, huge role in my life. I got really lucky, Archie. I had an opportunity when I was at IBM. I was probably 5-6 years in the company. And IBM decided that they wanted their high potential employees to have mentors. And what they did was they asked us, who would we like to be our mentor? And I was like, oh, okay. So I picked a guy by the name Roland Harris. He was a couple levels above me. I knew him. I thought he liked me. So I put his name down. Well, several days later, I get a call. It's Roland. Shelley. Hi, Roland. Shelley. You put my name down to be your mentor. I'm like, well, yeah, Roland, I thought you liked me. And he said, Shelley, you've got me. Go get somebody else. And I was like, oh, wow. What Roland said was, I could have as many mentors as I want. And what he also told me was this whole mentor-mentor thing doesn't have to be formal. I had no idea he thought of himself as a mentor. So I put all that on steroids and I decided, well, if one mentor is good, then two is better. And five is probably better than two. And you know, 10 is pretty good also. And so literally I adopted people throughout my career. So I've had a ton of mentors.
I love it. What's in it for the mentor?
This is where it's important to be a good mentee.
Yes.
Because frankly, if you aren't a good mentee, there is nothing in it for the mentor. And you know what? They're not going to give you their time. But what Maya Angelou always says, and I'm going to paraphrase it.
Give it to me.
People won't remember what you say. They won't remember what you do. They will remember how you made them feel. Well, being a good mentee is the same way. So Archie, I come to you and ask for advice. Oh, Archie, I have a speech to give. Do you have 2 or 3 quick tips for me on how I can make it a good one, right? And you'll share some things. Look people in the eye, add some humor, blah, blah, blah. Fine. I go off and do it. Now, for most people, they go off and do it. It does well. Everything's good. You never hear from them again, Archie. A good mentee circles back. They close the loop. Send you a quick note. Hey, Archie, I gave that speech. I took your advice. And oh my goodness, I was the most confident I've ever been. The audience really appreciated it. Thank you so much. Now what happens? You may not even remember the conversation. And now you get this note. And wow, you had this big impact on me, Shelley. Guess what happens? You feel good, right? You feel good. Odds are high that if I come back to you and ask you another question, you might answer it.
Yeah, very much so.
And that's how you create mentors.
I think you might have answered this one. I talk about 5 C's of leadership capital, capability, which we talked about, knowing your superpower, culture. So, you know, bringing your full self and your full history and heritage along with you, communication, connection, and confidence. Which of those is your strong suit and which is maybe an area of development for you?
Oh, gosh. You know, so I would say, I'm really going back and forth between communication and connection. I'd probably say connection.
Okay.
Is a strong suit. I would tell you that culture is one that over the arc of my career, I had to work on. Mm. You know, when I first started in business, it was in the early 80s in tech, right? There weren't a whole lot of women. I mean, I came to work looking like the guys, pinstripe suit, cotton shirt, little silk bow tie, right? I had nothing on my desk that gave any indication that I was married, had kids, the whole bit, right? I mean, I was trying to act like the guys, just the opposite of what we're talking about here.
Got it.
And what I found was it was exhausting.
Yeah.
It was exhausting, you know, and I was doing fine, but it was exhausting. I'm just like, and so when I finally started just being a little more relaxed, not taking myself so seriously, and, you know, being me, I was more impactful. I was less stressed. I was less tired, right? All those things. So over time, I became more and more comfortable, you know, to the point as a CEO, you know, people use analogies. They use a lot of sporting analogies, right? A lot of this analogies. I use cooking analogies because I like to cook. Early Shelley in her career never would have done that.
Do you have any thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners that we haven't covered thus far?
My biggest piece of advice for leaders is to realize that a manager is a title. And you can get a title anywhere. But to be a leader, you have to create followers. Your title doesn't matter. You can be a leader without a title, and you can not be a leader with a title.
Mm.
So if you want to be a true leader, and the title of this podcast is Training Camp for Leaders.
Yes, it is.
If you want to be a true leader, then you need to create an environment in which people want to be part of your team, where they want to follow you, where they want to work with you and be doing whatever it is that you're doing. When you create that kind of environment, now you're a true leader.
Did you hear that mic drop? Or was it just me? Anyways, here are my three key takeaways from Shelley. Number one, being unapologetically ambitious isn't being selfish or mean. It's about striving for excellence and making a big impact. So go for it. Number two, don't limit yourself to a single mentor. Use as many as you need to advance in your career. Just remember to be a good mentee by always showing your appreciation. And number three, true leadership lies in your actions, not your professional title. No matter where you are in your career, you can start acting like a leader right away. If you'd like more tips from Shelley, you can follow her on social media. If you enjoyed this episode, please don't forget to subscribe to Training Camp for Leaders with Archie L. Jones Jr. so you don't miss out on new episodes. Also, rate and leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. If you are a leader or aspiring to be one, visit ArchieLJonesJr.com. There you can pre-order my book, The Treasure You Seek, a guide to developing and leveraging your leadership capital, and connect directly with me. If you want to learn more about Next Gen Coach Network Governance Training Camp and the work we do, visit our website at NextGenCoachNetwork.com. That's spelled NXGEN CoachNetwork.com. Thank you so much for joining us, and I'll catch you all in the next episode. Training Camp for Leaders with Archie L. Jones Jr. is produced by Next Gen Coach Network and Human Group Media.